Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Mars. For generations, making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. When we talk Thanksgiving and its table of pure Americana, we forget something. We're a nation of other. I mean, except for Native Americans, all of us originally come from somewhere else. I mean, all of us were at one time foreigners. In a way, Chef Marcus Samuelson is a poster boy for this take on Americana. He was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, came to America in 1991 for 9 months, and he never left. Well, he's recently done a cookbook about what we Americans really are. It's The New American Table. Marcus came to town to teach some classes. We met up at the stove while he was prepping. He had two skillets going. The cutting boards had piles of cubed butternut squash, onions. He had just put a turkey breast in a roasting pan. And he came back to the counter to slice up some collard greens. So what are you doing? You've got a pile of bacon, a heap of bacon. And
I'm going to do a really nice turkey breast that we're going to do some stuffing with and some collard greens that I'm going to cook with some coconut milk. You know, I'm an immigrant to this country, and I love Thanksgiving because it's a holiday where, you know, you celebrate around food. But from immigrants, we don't really focus that much on the turkey. We will have a turkey there.
Yeah.
Because you want to sort of celebrate that you're in this new country. But we will have your herrings there, or your gravlax there, or your dorewat if you're Ethiopian, or if you're Indian, you have your other things. And then also looking at other holidays. You know, we looked at Jewish holidays, we looked at Kwanzaa.
Right.
That's one of the coolest things in America, is that no matter what ethnic group you're in or belong to or you want to belong to, there's something there for you, which is very few countries that celebrate the diversity of its new people, its immigrants, you know?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but everybody throws who they are into this particular holiday, more so maybe than any other.
Because it's not religious, it's not excluding anybody, it's inclusive, and it's food, you know?
Yeah.
And I can't speak about it because I was born in one place, raised in another part of the world, and now I live here, so I really see.
So you were born in Ethiopia,
yeah.
Right? And then you were raised
in Sweden.
Quite a combination.
Yeah. But I do say great food is all over the world, but in terms of the diverse food stories that you tell in America, no other country does that the way we've done it here.
So what have you got in the pans here?
We're going to do the turkey. We're going to just rub it with some herbs, pop it in the oven. Very simple. Then we got collard greens going, and I'm going to cook the collard greens with both collard greens and then also some bok choy. The collard greens are rough, a little bit harder in texture,
right?
And the bok choy are watery. And we're going to cook it with some coconut milk. And
that sounds fabulous.
Yes, very simple, but it's good. It's good.
Where does this recipe come from?
Well, this is actually inspired by a Filipino friend of mine, and she's married to a Swede. And when I did the book, look at my friends. All of them represent the other. The norm is the other. And I think that's what I wanted to celebrate, is that we're so diverse in our storytelling, in our family structure. And if a Filipino and a Swede live in New York, what would their refrigerator look like? You know, that's inspirational to me.
And this is essentially what their refrigerator looks like.
Absolutely. And they are just one example. The thing is, they are now becoming the norm.
You know, a friend of mine who's an anthropologist said that one of the glorious things about this country, and it especially shows up in the food, it's, by the way, also maybe one of the great problems we face, is that famous melting pot really doesn't melt, that we hold on to the traditions and to the identities.
We're not a melting pot. We're a salad. And I think that salad is even better because you're allowed to keep your identity. That's the cool thing. Like, so much about this is about food is an identity. You know, people say they're Italian-American. They've never been to Italy, but they still relate to Sicilian or whatever.
Yes, yes.
That's about an identity. That's great. And here that you're allowed to keep that identity, be part of that dialogue, I think it's fantastic.
I have to keep going back to those pots. I'm sorry. Bacon and sweet potatoes? And pumpkin and cinnamon sticks?
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
And that's in one pot.
Yes.
And then you've got the collard greens sauteing with the bok choy in the other pot.
We're going to blend this up here. I think about it in terms of texture, right?
Right.
So we're going to have the breadcrumb.
Okay, this goes into a roasting pan, yes. Right? Big chunks of bread.
Yeah, and then we're going to put it over here. We're just going to mix it well. We're going to have some pear for sweetness. And then we have the pumpkin. You know, so it's traditional in its structure in terms of sweet balance and so on. But it's also going to taste really, really great because you have the saltiness from the bacon and then you have the sweetness from the pear.
Oh, my. The aroma's great.
It better be.
So you've got now herbs going in here. Parsley?
Parsley, some rosemary.
Uh-huh. And you're deglazing the pan with some water or juice?
We use chicken stock this time, but it could be water.
Uh-huh. So get all those brown bits into the pan as well.
Now I'm just going to toss this around, add some salt in here.
Now where are you going to celebrate Thanksgiving?
In my house. People always come to my house in Harlem. We cook. And sometimes people bring dishes.
Uh-huh.
And I always have like 25 different nationalities in the house.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, like everybody, they're all American, but they're from different parts of the world.
Are there dishes that, for you, always say Thanksgiving that you have to have for yourself?
For me, it's even more smells. Cinnamon is one of them. It's kicking off the holiday season for me. Ginger snap cookies. Some turkey dish, right?
Right.
We have a lot of glögg at home. The Swedish, you know, the Swedish...
Isn't that a hot, spiced liquor?
Yes, glühwein, yes. Yeah. So that, it's more about the holiday season. It's the beginning of the holiday season, I think.
Now, this is going to be the stuffing?
Yes.
See, now, I have a premise about stuffing.
Tell me the premise.
The premise is, if you were to eat it on its own, it's absolutely fabulous.
Has to be, absolutely.
Okay, so we share that.
Absolutely. You look at this already, texture-wise, color-wise, you know it's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got the gold of the pumpkins and the white and the flecks of the green.
Mm-hmm.
So now is the collard a side dish in the coconut milk?
Side dish here.
All right. And the turkey, the bronze kind of roasted turkey goes on top.
Uh-huh. Really what we're doing is we're celebrating all types of cultures, all types of holidays. So whatever religion culture you're from, try to celebrate another one, you know?
Marcus, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
And have a very good Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Boy, does that look good.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Samuelson is author of New American Table. Now, for Marcus's Scandinavian Filipino menu of turkey breast with collard greens and stuffing of spiced pumpkin and peanuts, by the way, it is out of this world. All you have to do is go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, Marcus's menu is dead easy, but lest we forget, part of the success of a meal is not the food or the company. All through Thanksgiving dinner, your tukas has to rest on an object called a chair. Now, this can be an object of torture or one of bliss. Antique expert Judith Miller knows both ends of this deal. She's written over 80 books on collecting, but the one I covet is the latest. It's a study of seats, and it's called Chairs. Judith, welcome.
Thank you.
Judith, there's a quote in the book that kind of stopped me in my tracks, and this is the quote. It's easier to design a skyscraper than to design a chair. Is that true? And if it's true, why is it true?
Well, I think the chair is the thing we all take for granted. I mean, we all have chairs. We have kitchen chairs, we have dining chairs, and we often don't really look at them. But if you think about it, throughout history, all the designers, any designer you can name, will have tried to make a chair. And the thing is, it's got to be so multifunctional. I mean, I'm 5'5". My husband is 6'4". So it's very difficult for a designer to make the perfect chair.
One of the things that I found interesting is the chair as sort of the great tell of social status.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you go back in history, say to the 13th, 14th century, there would be only one chair in the room, and the person of higher status, other people would sit on benches or stand, but the person of higher status would take the chair. And if somebody of higher status came into the room, they would be given the chair. So, of course, that's where we get our idea for chairman. They are the most important person. They were the person who got the chair. So right from the start, the chair had tremendous significance. And I think, you know, with us as a family, and you were talking about Thanksgiving,
right.
I think one of the really important things for me about chairs is that my family all think it's bad, but, I mean, I have this whole thing that we all sit down together around our dining table in our chairs, and I have this thing, my chairs around my dining table, they're all different. They're not a set, but they were all made and designed about 1770, 1780. So I think it's rather quirky and rather nice to have these different chairs around my dining table.
This is an interesting idea, but now you're hitting a nerve for me, because that period, the 18th century, which is reproduced constantly, right? Mm. It seems that the chair at that time was really a work of art. It had curved legs. It had a back that had an angle that seemed to mold itself to the body. This leads to the question of, were there sort of high points through history of chair design?
No, absolutely. You know, if you take, I mean, it was sort of our Queen Anne period, slightly before the American Queen Anne period, but that was a wonderful time for elegant chairs. They were beginning to work out how to get rid of the bottom stretchers so that the actual dynamic of the chair could stand on its own. And that's when you start to get, just after that, you start to get those wonderful cabrio legs.
Those are the curved legs, yeah.
And there's that ball and claw foot. You know, that was real craftsmanship. And, of course, later in the century, I mean, Chippendale and Chippendale style was, this is when, you know, obviously, both in the US and in the UK, there were a lot more people with the money to afford really good furniture. So mm-hmm. the furniture craftsmen were producing, you know, wonderful pieces. But then you've got your federal period where you get your really neoclassical chairs, which are really exciting too. And all the way through, you know, the Victorian, where people got just bigger and more elaborate and more excessive. And then you got the fabulous Art Nouveau chairs at the turn of the century, but and at the same time as the arts and crafts chair by people like Gustav Stickley. You know, the choice is amazing when you start looking at chairs.
But the ultimate thing about a chair is comfort. Do you see any mass manufacturers, like, for instance, IKEA, that are producing that chair that's a great chair to sit at a table?
Well, I think what a lot of the manufacturers do, people like Vitra and many manufacturers, they take the great designer chair and change it slightly often for mass production. So I do think there are some very good chairs. There are some very uncomfortable chairs that are produced.
Yes, I have that feeling about a Frank Lloyd Wright dining chair with absolutely straight back, absolutely flat seat, and no one in their right mind could spend more than 15 minutes in that chair.
Another exactly the same, Charles Rennie Mackintosh in Scotland. His chairs are so uncomfortable. They're fabulous looking, but my goodness, they're uncomfortable.
I don't think they like to socialize. Judith, thanks so much for talking with us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Antique authority and collector Judith Miller is author of Chairs. Now, coming up, the dumpling as a cooking lesson from Mom and my annual Thanksgiving menu. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More information and tips to help you make healthy decisions can be found at MarsHealthyLiving.com. One of the psychologically interesting things about hosting the Thanksgiving feast is that you get to choose what traditions you keep from your family of origin and what you don't. It also seems to be an easier time to ask for help. Sonia Pajak left her native Czechoslovakia in 1949, and now, at 84, her son Ben, who studies insects for a living, joins her in her kitchen.
Flour, milk, 4 cups of breadcrumbs, yeast. I use 2 envelopes for 5 cups of flour and put 1 cup of warm water into it. Be sure it's warm, not hot. Sugar, 1 tablespoon sugar into it, and mix it smoothly, and be sure that your oven is ready. I turned it a few seconds and have the warmth for the yeast to, they call it, proving itself.
It's Thanksgiving Day, 2008. I'm with my mother, Sonia Pajak. Tell me, Mom, what are we going to do?
So what we are going to do to learn how to cook a very special dumpling called the bread yeast Viennese dumpling.
How do you say it in Czech?
Vídeňský houskový knedlík. And also takes know-how how to succeed with it. Therefore, I want Ben to learn it because he had no chance ever to watch it. The timer. You have to go. And now you make holes to get the hot air out.
Is that a special tool?
It's
a needle. You took these 2 loaves of bread dumplings out of a hot boiling pot. Mm-hmm. What are you doing now?
I'm slicing them with dental floss because they are so delicate. The knife would collapse them. I'm satisfied. This is a wonderful, delicate, light like a cotton dough, but it has solid pieces of white bread cubes, which were cut and dried in the oven. So that has to be all ready before you start making dumplings. Kitchen timer is a little clock-like. For 10 minutes, I have to be sure the water is boiling when I form the loaf with wet hands under running water and put it in.
I gotta tell you what this reminds me of. The color and the shape looks like a big termite abdomen.
Now that is...
Like a that's
a joke.
A termite queen. If you've ever seen them, they have this white, shiny...
I think I am teaching entomologists some new tricks here. That is funny. Every married Czech man who is worth his salt will know how to make this particular dinner. This dumpling and the cabbage and then the meat, that is a normal fare they have for holidays, so they all know how to do it.
So how's it look?
It looks perfect. I hope it will taste as good as it looks. You have to use the sauce to flood the dumpling. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a slice of that very tender pork.
More.
Okay, this is cabbage. Okay? You are committing a cardinal sin.
What do you mean?
Ready to eat without beer in front? What happened to the beer?
Why beer?
Because it's greasy and beer is supposed to be the catalyst, the healthy catalyst, to help to digest it right.
I'll go get the beer. This is a little unusual, isn't it, Mom? I mean, this is Thanksgiving dinner and you and I are together and we're not having turkey. We're having vepšo knedlo.
Zelo. Vepšo knedlo zelo. Zeli is cabbage.
Bon appetit, Mom.
Thank you.
Ben Pajak is an entomologist in Annapolis, Maryland. His mother, Sonia, lives in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Well, every year I like to come up with a new Thanksgiving feast menu. Now, if you're looking for the turkey recipe of the season, check out the website. There's several of them up there. But this year I'm taking a completely different tack. I have got a menu for a meatless Thanksgiving. And yeah, if you add the turkey, everybody's going to be happy. But I think vegetarians and vegans have been politely surviving on cranberry sauce, creamed onion, and mashed potatoes for all too long. This is your year, guys. Now, the menu plays on the idea of true Americana, as in the original foods of the Americas, you know, the ones that changed the way Europe ate, moved the earth, if you will. Now, the entire menu, all eight dishes, is up on the website. Check it out. It's Lynn's Americana Thanksgiving. Just go to splendidtable.org. Nauseam, we hear how the pilgrim story of turkey, stuffing, and pumpkin didn't happen. So how did we end up with an entire country eating like little piglets on the fourth Thursday of November? Well, Andrew Smith's middle name should be Mythbuster. Andrew's a food historian and teacher at the New School University in New York City. He specializes in American culinary history. Andy, welcome.
Oh, Lynn, it's wonderful to be here.
Now, I think of you as the official myth buster of, you know, American food history. What's the real story behind the Thanksgiving feast?
Well, as you pointed out, the Pilgrims had very little to do with it. Thanksgiving really was a creation of the late 18th century, early 19th century. And it just was Americans wanted a national holiday in the fall. And so a large number of people, particularly those in New England, decided they were going to create a national holiday for us in the fall. At the time, there were only two national holidays. One was Washington's birthday in February, and the other was the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And neither at the time were particularly associated with food. But Thanksgiving, which was the fall holiday, was directly associated with food almost from the beginning. And it became a national holiday during the American Civil War when President Lincoln thought America had something to celebrate after the victories of Gettysburg and Vicksburg. So it really took off from there and has been ingrained in school textbooks and magazines and newspapers and even radio programs, if you can believe that.
I would never believe that. But here's the thing about Thanksgiving I always wonder about. Every country in the world has harvest feasts and Thanksgiving feasts, and so do we. So kind of what's the big deal?
No, at no place in the world is Thanksgiving celebrated the way it is in the United States. It's initially a religious ceremony and a public ceremony mm-hmm. that celebrates the end of the harvest. Those things are absolutely true. But the Thanksgiving that we had didn't start that way at all. You could have Thanksgiving any time of the year. It really wasn't required that it be in the fall. And it was only later that when Sarah Josepha Hale decided that it was going to be on the third Thursday of November that it really became a fall festival. Prior to the time, you could and did have Thanksgiving in the spring or in the mm-hmm, summer. Mm-hmm. Anytime anything happened that was really great, you would call a Thanksgiving for it.
Who was Sarah Josepha Hale?
Sarah Josepha Hale was, I think, the first female novelist in America. She wrote two really great novels in the 1820s, and one of which had a whole chapter on Thanksgiving. And it's that chapter that in many ways becomes ingrained as the traditional Thanksgiving, with the turkey and the dressing and uh-huh, the gravy uh-huh. and all of the other things that we think of. And it just so happened that her novel gave her great popularity. She became the editor of the most popular women's magazine in the mid-19th century, Gottes book on Gottes magazine. And she took a very prominent role in creating fashion in America. And one of the fashions that she created was the Thanksgiving dinner. And she intentionally engaged in a campaign for 17 years through her work as editor to create this national holiday, finally succeeding in 1863.
You know, this all sounds so idealistic. Were there any naysayers?
Oh, yeah. The Alcotts and Sylvester Graham, for instance, and John Harvey Kellogg, they all were opposed to Thanksgiving, in part because the turkey being a part of the meal, and they were all vegetarians. But in addition to that, they thought that feasting itself was bad and was immoral and was not healthy for you. So they had a whole series. And then, of course, the American Indian Movement begins as a protest against a number of holidays, of which Thanksgiving was one. And that certainly continues well into the 21st century.
Well, Andy, may the feast be plentiful and may your table be filled with people you care about.
Thank you, Lynn.
And thank you. Andrew Smith tells all about Thanksgiving and a lot more in his book, Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Okay, it is time for us to talk. Give us a call, 800-537-5252, or email at splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Let's see, we have got Kahin on the phone calling from Nashville. Kahin, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about butternut squash.
Ooh, yeah.
Earlier this summer, I planted about four plants, thinking I was going to get three or four off of each one, but it turns out we got over 100.
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it, about this squash family?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised at that. It's growing and growing and growing.
Oh,
and we've given away so much and we've done so much with it. I've really run out of ideas.
So what do you have now left? Maybe about 60 pounds of butternut squash?
Yes, probably.
Well, the very first thing that comes to mind is pumpkin pie, because although now we have a lot of sweet pumpkins, for the longest time, I always thought pumpkins didn't have very much flavor. But
right.
What I always would do is split the butternut squash and roast it.
That seems to be the best way.
Yeah, and then puree it and, you know, add all the ingredients, and that was the pumpkin pie. But, you know, I think one of the other things about the squash is that it's really delicious treated as a sauté. Have you tried cutting it into cubes or into thin sticks and browning it?
And I have. That's actually my favorite way of eating it.
I would suggest, this is the Italian take, but the idea of you cut it into thin sticks, you brown it, you let it sauté. You might want to even add a little bit of broth or something to the pan to just help it cook a little. You don't want it stewed. But in the meantime, you grate lemon rind over it and you sauté it with a bit of garlic and rosemary.
Okay.
Some fresh rosemary, and that adds a nice touch to it. Of course, sweet squash filling for ravioli, and you could, I mean, it's cheating, but who cares? You could just put it in wonton wrappers if you wanted to. But I mean, it works. The idea is
right.
That you could brown that squash or you could roast it. And then you either fine chop it or you puree it with nutmeg.
Okay.
I would not mind a little bit of cinnamon with that. And then some good Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. And then that gets folded into that pasta, that wonton, and you boil it. And it's delicious.
Okay.
Have you ever tried doing a sweet pudding with it?
I haven't.
Well, if you think about the filling you would normally put in a pumpkin pie, that idea, the balance of the egg to the pureed squash.
Okay.
In some words, take any pumpkin pie filling. And what you do is look at the balance of egg and perhaps milk or cream to the puree.
Right.
Okay. But now, instead, you're going to add to that other seasonings. You're going to do vanilla, which is utterly fabulous with butternut squash. And you might do, believe it or not, some candied orange or candied lemon peel.
Really?
Yeah. Or the vanilla with candied ginger chunks.
That sounds good.
Yeah. And you make it with some half and half and the eggs. and you slow bake it in a water bath. So you put it into a container that you've buttered very nicely, you know, and generously. You lightly cover it with foil, and then you put it in a slightly larger container. You put that in the oven, and you pour boiling water down the side of that slightly larger container so it comes halfway up the side of the butternut squash container. And you do about 325. You want to do it slow, and it should reach an internal temperature of about 170 degrees.
Okay.
And let it cool in that water bath. And if you're going to let it cool in the water bath, just with the oven turned off and the door open, take it to 160, because then it'll finish cooking.
Okay.
And it's a really delicate, delicious, lovely thing, and you can serve it in wine glasses with a little cream over it. It could be fabulous.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So give that a shot.
I will definitely do that.
I just keep thinking of hundreds of pounds of beautiful butternut squashes.
I mean, trust me. We've given it away. I've had to force it on people, and it's just so much of it. We didn't know what to do.
Hey, thank you, Colleen. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to be back with more of your questions in a minute. The number is 800-537-5252. But right now, I have got this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, which founding father wanted to see the turkey on the presidential seal? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we will be taking more of your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More information and tips to help you make healthy decisions can be found at MarsHealthyLiving.com. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls and questions in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or get to us online via splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which founding father wanted to see the turkey on the presidential seal? Well, it was Benjamin Franklin. It was back in 1784. Franklin had been sent a drawing of the new seal for the new country. And he was incensed. The eagle, which was on the seal, was not his bird of choice. He fumed about it being, and I'm quoting here, a bird of bad moral character. He accused it of being a coward, a robber, lazy, and full of lice. Much better to have the official seal of the United States feature a turkey. Now, he explains that the turkey is native to our continent, which, by the way, the eagle is not. But more important is that although the turkey, and this is Franklin talking, can be vain and silly, it is a bird of great courage. An American turkey would confront a redcoat soldier head on if the soldier even dared to invade the bird's barnyard. Well, that's fine, except I wonder if we'd be eating our national symbol every Thanksgiving. Okay, back to the phones. Your calls reach us, 800-537-5252, or email splendidtable.org. And remember, anything goes. Let's see, who is up? We have got Andrew calling from Seattle. Hey, Andrew, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm hoping to pick your brain for some ideas for Thanksgiving this year. Last year, we made your orange basil turkey, and
it turned out
perfectly.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to do something, I don't know, different, but just as flavorful and kind of unique because everybody seemed to enjoy it and they've never had anything like that.
Oh, boy. So all you're asking is simply, could I come up with something no one's ever seen before, right, that'll be absolutely delicious? Sure. To kind of, shall we say, lean on past work, so to speak, on the website, you know, splendidtable.org, we've got two recipes I have done for years, and I love them. And they're slightly different in the way they're roasted than the orange basil turkey, which was roasted at high temperature. These are roasted at a lower temperature, but the ideas are similar. One is a turkey that is flavored with a North African sauce or seasoning called shamula. And that's a puree of fresh coriander and parsley and paprika and garlic and lemon and spices. And and if you want to, you can add hotter spices, but you don't have to. It's very much Moroccan / Tunisian flavors. And you slip that under the skin and you let it sit overnight. You could have brined the turkey first if you wanted to. But then the idea is you take the turkey out of the brine the day before Thanksgiving and you slip all of this under the skin of the turkey, rub the rest of it all over it and in the cavity. And you just make it in a food processor. I mean, it's very easy to make the sauce.
Okay.
And then the next day, you roast it at 325. And this is going to be juicy and tender, and it has a ton of flavor. Now, that recipe is on the website. And the other recipe that's on the website is essentially, I call it three-generation roast Thanksgiving turkey, because it's a takeoff on how my grandmother, my mother, and then me, how we all made the Thanksgiving turkey, and it has a definite Italian note to it. It's a combination of green herbs like rosemary and thyme and basil and olive oil and garlic, but it goes under the skin. It sits overnight, which just helps the flavor permeate a little bit. And then again, roasted at 325 and basted with wine, which was a thing my grandmother and my mother always did. And you do it in a fairly shallow pan so that you get a lot of evaporation and you get fabulous pan juices. And by the way, both of these recipes have the gravy recipe built into them.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So these take longer to roast than the basil turkey, but I think you'll like them a lot. And they're two completely different takes on the roast turkey.
Thank you so much, Lynn. They both sound perfect.
Yeah, just see what you think. And the other thing is, both of them are roasted on beds of vegetables. And I love to do that because those vegetables give so much to the pan juices. And certain people in our family have been known to grab those vegetables, even though they're loaded with turkey fat and whatever, out of the pan, put them in foil, put them in the refrigerator, and the next day they saute them until they're very, very brown and eat them for breakfast with eggs. But I won't tell you who does that. So I hope that helps, Andrew.
Yeah, it definitely does. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you are welcome. You are welcome. Have a great holiday.
All right, you too. Take care.
You too. Bye. They're up there on the website, guys. The Moroccan turkey and the three-generation turkey. SplendidTable.org. Not saying it's the last word on turkey. There will never be in this country a last word on turkey. You can reach us at SplendidTable.org. Or you can call us, 800-537-5252. Anything goes, anything you want to talk about. We got a voicemail from Mona in Ferrisburg, Vermont. Now, Mona says she would like to make her pumpkin pie ahead. Can she freeze it baked or unbaked? Well, Mona, I don't think you're going to have great success freezing a pumpkin pie, and this is why. Because basically the filling is a custard, and it can tend to break down in freezing. Also, I don't care what anybody tells you about a frozen pie with a moist filling. When you defrost that baby or when you just bake it frozen, it's always soggy at the bottom. So here's what I would tell you to do to make it ahead. I always pre-bake my pie crusts. So you would put it in the pan, you'd line it with foil, weight it down with things like dried beans or rice, bake it at 400 for 8 to 10 minutes until the crust has started to really firm up. Take that out of the oven, very gently lift out that lining of foil, prick the bottom of the crust, put it back in, and just let it finish baking. You want it to be dry looking. Once that is cooled, you can keep it for a day easily. Just hold it at room temperature. And with anything that has a custard in it, like a pumpkin pie, a chess pie, that can be done ahead and put in the refrigerator. Fruits, generally, you want to slice those up the same day you're going to bake the pie. Now, when you want to actually bake off the pie, you can do that Thanksgiving morning. And that means you just take that pumpkin pie filling out of the fridge, bring it close to room temperature, pour it into the pie crust, put it in a preheated oven, and bake it however the recipe tells you to bake it. You can do something very similar with any pie. Your apple pie, pre-bake the bottom crust, put the apples in, and then put the raw pie crust on top of it and bake away. Now, you want to seal that raw top crust to the bottom baked crust, right? Well, first of all, you've made sure that before you bake that bottom crust, that crust is coming up and over the lip of the pie pan. Now, when you're ready to put the fruit in, you put the fruit in, then you drape that top raw crust over it. But first, you've brushed the rim of that baked crust with beaten egg. And you just press. And you're sealed. So that's how you can do a bit of baking ahead for Thanksgiving. Have a great holiday, Mona. And everybody else, you can reach us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. We have got Elizabeth calling from Newton, North Carolina. Elizabeth, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about aligot.
The dish from central France that's done with potatoes and cheese.
And fresh thyme, yes. My family and I vacationed with some friends who have a summer house there in the Languedoc region.
Uh-huh.
And we were treated to aligot, and it was the most delicious potato dish I've ever had in my life. And this Thanksgiving, nothing would make me more thankful than to have a dish of aligot on my table.
Well, for those who have never tried this, because I remember it, we used to go to I'm really throwing this around. When we lived in Europe, when we would go to Paris on the weekend, we would always on Friday night go to a restaurant called the Ambassade de Auvergne, which is, it may be the region where the dish originated, but wherever it originated, the Auvergne region is in the center of France.
Yes.
And they had copper pots, so they would bring these mashed potatoes that they would whip with cheese right to the table. And if you could imagine, if you've never had this, a really nice cheese whipped into your mashed potatoes with just a whisper of garlic and butter or creme fraiche, it would just be fabulous. And they'd sort of drape it on the plate. Okay, you want to make this yourself, right?
Yes. I mean, it has this texture. Ugh.
There are many ways of doing it, but the key here is you want baking potatoes like russet potatoes or Idaho's. You boil those in their skin, you know, until they're fairly tender. You let them cool a bit, you peel them, you mash them into a pot where you add creme fraiche or a little sour cream.
Okay.
You add a bit of butter.
Okay.
And then the cheese. Now, the cheese you had is something called tome. What tome is, it can be any number of kinds of milk, but it's generally a fresh cheese.
Yeah, this was a fresh cheese made with sheep's milk, actually.
Okay. Now, you can use as your tome any kind of lightly aged sheep cheese that has a nice flavor.
Okay.
And there are a ton of them made by American cheesemakers. Now, another traditional way of doing it is to use a cheese that's called Beaufort, which is aged a bit. And Beaufort always reminds me of a mixture of a really dynamite cheddar and Parmigiano Reggiano.
Okay.
Crush the potatoes with a potato ricer or masher.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start adding the cheese to the hot potatoes. You're doing this over medium heat, medium low heat in the pan.
And you're stirring the heck out of it, right?
You are stirring the heck out of it. You want to stir it, and you want a lot of cheese in there.
Okay. Like how much?
If you have a couple of pounds of potatoes, I'd have a half a pound or three quarters of a pound of cheese.
Okay.
And I'd keep adding it and tasting. But the idea, too, is you may want a little hot milk, but you want the butter, and you want a bit of that sour cream.
Okay.
And the idea is you beat it until it ribbons off of the wooden spoon you're using to beat it.
Okay.
And you can rewarm it and, you know, get it alive again so you don't have to do it the last minute.
That's fabulous.
All right.
It's going to be on my table.
You have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care, Elizabeth. Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, there's a group of people who celebrate Thanksgiving together every year. It's the Turkey Tech Gang at Instructable.com. Now, many of them are college friends with backgrounds in science and engineering. Thanksgiving is fodder for a take on DIY that you will never see on a cable show. Turkey Tech member Charles Fox is on the phone. Charles, welcome.
Thank you.
So what is on the agenda for Thanksgiving this year?
Oh, the plan right now is that we're going to have sort of several Thanksgivings this year, basically a turkey every 8 hours.
So is the idea is a group of you are going to go, what, from house to house?
No, it'll all be at one location. sort of a cyclic pattern to the meals.
So just as you have sort of started to get over one meal, you're going to have another one ready to roll.
Right, right.
So how many will you be?
I'm not sure how many people will actually show up, but in the past, it's been probably 40 folks or so.
Oh, I think a dishwasher redesign is necessary. But there's a design I have to ask you about because I think it's your baby. The gravy fountain, I have it up on my computer right now, and it is a faucet with the gravy flowing out of it into a bowl, and then it waterfalls down to another bowl, and it disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this idea come from, and how does it work?
I think the background on this was maybe three or four years ago, and at this time I'd started seeing these chocolate fountains. You know, so I'd been to a couple weddings over the summer where people had this at their wedding banquet, and this just seemed, you know, sort of so opulent and ridiculous to have a waterfall of chocolate, and somehow having a gravy fountain seemed like the natural extension of this idea to the Thanksgiving setting. Of course, you know, we needed some mechanism to actually pump the gravy around. So to make a gravy fountain, you need to make a gravy pump, and the chocolate fountain just relies on the viscosity of the chocolate to sort of pull it up this screw kind of drive mechanism. And one of the problems with that is if you have a giblet gravy, then you would worry the giblets might jam your pump. And so the design of this is a peristaltic pump. So the fountain has sort of a rotating drive, which kind of squeezes the gravy up through a flexible tube, and it cascades out the front and then down into sort of a pool at the bottom, which is heated. So there's a heating element in there to keep the gravy warm.
So I gather you just walk up to it. Maybe you could stick your plate under it, get the gravy, and you're off and running. I love this idea. What are some of the other kind of intriguing things you all have come up with?
A couple that I've been involved with have been focused on sort of dessert. One year we made kind of a giant pecan pie in a very interesting pan that was sort of the shape of a big snowflake. And so that required actually building an oven. It wouldn't fit in my oven. It was about 48 inches across.
Really intriguing stuff.
Yeah, so I would say the most probably extreme along that line is one year someone showed up with all the components of a Thanksgiving dinner, so think mashed potatoes and cranberry and stuffing and so on, except that they had dried them out, ground them up, and packed them into gelatin capsules as though they were pills. And so they brought in a suitcase, which they opened up, that revealed bags and bags of pills. I mean, it looked like some, scene of a drug dealer's, lair or something in a movie, except that, each package of brightly colored pills contained a different component of Thanksgiving dinner. So there is something about Thanksgiving that it's this sort of celebration of excess and kind of, it has this ridiculous character to it already in some ways, that you would, prepare this giant meal and, you sort of founder yourself, and that inspires some of this pushing in this absurd direction.
I love it. Thanks so much for sharing it with us, and have a great holiday.
Thank you.
Take care, Charles. Charles Fox is part of the Turkey Tech Group at Instructables.com. Now, if you want to take a shot at your own gravy fountain or snowflake pecan pie, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great Thanksgiving, and until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "I awoke this morning with devout thanksgiving for my friends, the old and the new." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Palm Wonderful. 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle. Palm Wonderful, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com and by gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our omnipresent website, splendidtable.org. Not only are you going to find newsletters and podcasts, you'll find a recipe archive and a collection of inexpensive recipes we've put together to get you cooking. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Thanks to Cooks of Crocus Hill in St. Paul for letting us mess up their kitchen with Marcus. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Have a great Thanksgiving, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.